In Exodus, the third chapter, the first through the sixth verses we read, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert, and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. This is a point in Moses' life about 40 years after leaving Egypt. We recall, of course, that he had been reared as a member of Pharaoh's family and had received the benefits of education and position which would be available to such. St. Stephen, the martyr, reported this in his speech before the Sanhedrin when he stated, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. However, in spite of the position and honor Moses had as a member of Pharaoh's family, his interest and sympathies were with his people Israel. So strong was this feeling that it prompted him to slay an Egyptian whom Moses saw brutally mistreating an Israelite. Realizing the seriousness of the act, he sought to conceal it by hiding the body. But the act became known, and we read in Exodus 2:15 that Pharaoh sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled and dwelt in the land of Midian, and sat down by a well. While resting at this desert oasis, Moses watched 7 young women bringing a flock of sheep to the well for watering. But when they started to fill the troughs, some shepherds began to interfere. This aroused the ire of this just man, and he successfully interceded on behalf of the young women. Then he also assisted them in the task of watering the sheep, performing the most difficult part of filling the troughs with water. The 7 grateful and impressed young women returned home much more quickly than usual because of his help. When the father Jethro learned of all this, he insisted Moses be brought to his home as a guest. And, as one would expect in time, Moses took to wife one of the young women, Zipporah. How different was Moses' life in Midian from that of Egypt? From the comforts of the civilization and rich life of Egypt, he was suddenly transplanted to the raw desert and the humble task of herding sheep under primitive conditions. Broken, too, were the tender ties of family and friends which had meant so much. In the 40 years between the incident at the well and the scripture which opened our lesson, Moses must have wondered much and often about his people Israel yet in Egypt. But we know he had not been forgotten of God. These 40 years had been developing rich growth of character. He had been learning well the lesson of humility, which would be so necessary for one whom God would lift so high among the children of men. And in a practical way, he had been roaming over the very wide expanse of desert, which God knew would be the route to Canaan which Israel would trod. We can benefit by thus observing the hand of God working in the life of another. Do not we also have the desert experiences? By force of circumstance, we may be set aside for a while and to outward appearances be forgotten of God. But the hand that led Moses to the burning wilderness of Midian continued with him the 40 years. And God's gentle leadings for us may be from triumph to testing, from abundant fellowship to lonely days, but in it all he will be there to direct however strange the circumstance. The particular day in Moses' life recorded in Exodus 3:1 must have seemed to be just another one in a long succession of lonely ones. In our mind's eye, we can visualize him as he arose that day to begin the normal activities. As he stood without his tent, how differently he appeared than when in Egypt. His garments were of rough, homespun cloth, adequate but not necessarily appealing to the eye. His feet were shod with sandals that in all probability his own hands had fashioned. And in his hand was the shepherd's rod, which was to become so important in his life. As he stood gazing over the vista before him, he little realized how momentous would be that day and yet many days to follow. That day, in a special sense, he was to begin a career as an highly honored servant of God. We, too, who are children of God, can look back to a similar point of time in our lives. Once, with many of us, we were in the world just drifting with the tide of men and quite unmindful of our God or His plan. But there came that day, that special day, when we heard a discourse or read a tract, or in some other way heard the voice of God, and our lives were changed forevermore. As Moses walked with the sheep, he was startled by the appearance of a burning bush. And as he looked, he realized that, although burning furiously, the bush was not consumed into ashes. When he went closer to inspect, he heard coming from the bush a deep, resonant voice speaking his own name, "Moses, Moses." Instinctively, he answered, "Here am I." Then it was that he heard the voice identify itself by the memorable words, "Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." Moreover, he said, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Fear gripped him, and he covered his face with his hands and turned away from the strange sight. But the voice of God continued speaking. And Moses heard God speak of the sad plight of his people in Egypt. And also came the welcome news that they were to be delivered from bondage into their own land flowing with milk and honey. Then the voice of God spoke to Moses in a most direct manner, saying, "Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." These words seemed to shock Moses, and he recovered from his startled fear and attempted to reason with God and even argue against the suggestion. No doubt he quickly recalled the pomp and grandeur of Pharaoh's court, and just as quickly contrasted his own rustic appearance. For 40 years as a stranger in a strange land, he had tended sheep far from the busy throng and out of touch with the progress of that day. The long years of menial work under primitive conditions had taken away Moses' youthful self-assurance. He felt inadequate for what God had suggested. Note how this is shown in his reply. "And Moses said unto God, Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" How much we can sympathize with Moses in this statement. Was not that the attitude of some of us when we began to realize we were being invited to become a son of God, to be used in delivering the world from bondage? As we realize the grandeur of the call, its lofty purpose, the holiness of our God, did not we say, "Who am I that God should call me?" We too needed assurances, as did Moses. Then it was that God began patiently to explain to fearful Moses how the deliverance would be accomplished. He answered questions Moses asked. God told him Pharaoh would resist, but that he would force compliance by a demonstration of wonderful power. But at the conclusion of God's speaking, doubtful Moses again expressed his fears in the words, "But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee." And then came to Moses a most unusual question. "And the Lord said unto him, What is that in thine hand?" How well Moses knew what he had in his hand. It was the mark of his work, a shepherd's rod or stick. If his eyes had rested upon it at that time, he would have noted the well-worn rod which he had probably used for years. It was a stick he had cut from a tree to be used in herding his sheep or killing harmful snakes or overturning rocks. A useful thing, to be sure, but very commonplace and of no value. But, in a sense, it represented about all Moses had, because the sheep he tended were the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. What an abrupt change in thought was this question. Prior to this, God had been outlining his momentous plan for liberating Israel. And now he asked, "What is that in thine hand?" Puzzled Moses answered with the simple words, "A rod." And as he did, he probably reached out his hand, which grasped it. What did God mean? Immediately came the command, "Cast it on the ground." Moses instinctively obeyed, and the rod became a writhing, hissing snake from which Moses in terror fled until halted by the voice of God. Once more the voice commanded, "Put forth thine hand and take it by the tail." No doubt Moses was fearful and hesitant in complying, but at the moment he touched the serpent, which had been so loathsome, it became once more the familiar rod of old. By this and other miracles, Moses realized he was to go as God's servant, and that the power of God would go with him. The final words of God on this occasion were, "And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs." In a sense, the stick represented all that Moses had. But in the experience, God was showing that the possessions of the servant mattered little. What did matter was the willingness of the servant to obediently use that which he possessed. God had the power, the wisdom for every occasion. In faith, Moses was simply to follow instructions. Moses, humble, austere condition of life well represents us when we are called. The Apostle Paul states in 1 Corinthians 1:27 that God hath chosen the foolish, weak, despised ones of the world to confound the mighty, that no flesh should glory in his presence. We who are now servants of God might hesitate to perform the will of God. We might say, "Who am I that, and with what can I perform his will?" If we do, then the Lord could ask of us, as he did of Moses, "What is that in thine hand? What do we have right now?" One may answer, "Only time. I have retired." Such a one may say, "My funds are just enough to care for basic needs, so what can I do?" But in the Lord's providence, this time can be used and blessed mightily. A tract can be given, a word-of-mouth witness, a letter of comfort, a visit of mercy. The question is not, "How little have I," but only, "What is it?" If the spirit of love and service is there, God can direct its use and bless the result. And so with us all. Should not we in prayerful introspection see what we have in our hand that God can bless? Time, talent, money, intellect, position, are some of the things we do have in our hand and should use, because these are no longer ours. This fact of our possessions being only ours by reason of stewardship is brought out in Moses' experience. When Moses realized he was to go as God's servant, he made arrangements with his father-in-law to take his family and depart. The account reads in Exodus 4:20, "And Moses took his wife and his sons, and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand." Notice the latter part of this text. "And Moses took the rod of God in his hand." Indeed, the commonplace rod had now an honored place. No longer would it be used to prod sheep, strike snakes, or overturn rocks. Why? It was now the rod of God. It had changed ownership. Indeed, such is the case with us who have become disciples of Jesus. That which we had in our hands at consecration, great or small, that which represented all that we had in every way, now belongs to God. And as Moses used the rod thereafter at God's direction, so we as stewards are to use our time, talents, our all as God directs. And if we do, God will bless the effort. The result of his blessing, our efforts may be readily seen and be great, as was with the case of Moses. Or we may need to wait until the kingdom to see the full end accomplished by this power on our behalf. But whether results are now great or small matters not. What does matter is our willingness to be used. In looking back over the long history of God's dealings with his servants, we can see many instances which illustrate God's power blessing the little thing in the hand of a servant. In reverie, let our minds go back to a faraway time in Israel's history. At the time we have in mind, the Israelites are to be found cowering fearfully in the mountain fastness. They had been driven there by a ruthless enemy who were wantonly plundering the farms of the defeated people. The position of Israel seemed hopeless because the conquering nation, now entrenched, greatly outnumbered them, and besides, this hostile people were naturally warlike. From the heights above, one could look down upon the enemy's well-disciplined army, numbering 135,000. Israel had no army at this time, and there seemed no possible solution for the hopeless situation. That is, there was no solution unless one would look to God obediently and with faith. Imagine us back there at that time and perceiving a young, determined man of Israel in earnest conversation with a few men. As we approach, we inquire, "What is that in thine hand?" Promptly comes the reply, "An earthenware pitcher with a lamp inside." How strange it would have seemed to us back then if the one to whom we spoke insisted that with such meager implements, he and the 300 with him expected to rout the mighty host below. Yet such was the case when Gideon and his band of 300 were used of God to defeat the Midianites. It was all they had in their hand, but in their hearts great faith. So God blessed it with a resounding victory. We read that Gideon deployed the 300 in the hills surrounding the Midianites in the valley below. At a given signal from their leader, each blew a trumpet, then shouted out the words, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." Then they broke the pitchers to reveal the lamps inside, and consternation broke out among the army below, which had bedded down for the night. It appears that the enemy mistook each light to be a torch-bearer of a troop. Historians indicate that it was the custom in that day for each torch-bearer to represent 6,000 warriors. Hence the Midianites quickly concluded they were surrounded by a poised force larger than their own. In the darkness, confusion reigned, and the Midianites' hands were turned against each other, and a rout ensued. All that Gideon and his men had in their hands were a pitcher, a lamp, and a trumpet. But in their hearts was a willingness to serve God and faith that he would provide the victory, and he did. Once more comes the question to us, "What is that in thine hand?" We leave the memorable time of Gideon's defeat of the Midianites and travel down to another troubled point in Israel's history. At this time, Israel had an army, well trained and ready for battle. A valley separated them from a formidable army of Philistines, and the Israelites were afraid. In addition to being fearful, they were being daily humiliated by a personal challenge from a monstrous man. His daily taunt was, as recorded in 1 Samuel 17, 10-11, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. History records that at such a time when Israel was being subjected to the taunts of evil Goliath, the boy David came on the scene. The boy was shocked to see the army of Israel flee from the presence of such a man, and in dismay he proclaimed, "Who is the Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" This very statement of David does much to reveal his faith. To him this was not Israel's army, nor that of Saul, but it was the army of the living God. This living faith in the heart of youthful David prompted him to speak of his willingness to accept Goliath's challenge. When word reached Saul concerning one in camp willing to do battle for Israel in single combat, David was called before him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him," that is Goliath. "Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." But youthful David was not to be denied. With enthusiasm and displaying great faith, he recounted previous deliverance he had by the hand of God while doing battle with wild beasts. In conclusion, he said, "The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine." It appears that his rich faith in God greatly impressed King Saul, and he agreed to David fighting as a representative of God in Israel. Saul's sympathies were with David to such an extent that he made arrangements for the youth to wear the king's armor. However, after David had on the helmet and coat of mail and had placed a sword on his side, he decided against wearing the armor. This he did because, in his words, he had not proved it. That is, he felt unqualified to wear such armor unless he had previously been victorious in combat. If we'd been present at that time, we would have wondered greatly as he began to remove the implements of war. Especially would we have been concerned because it was apparent that David intended to do battle. We would have watched as the unarmed youth, with only staff in hand, headed down the valley and towards the mighty Goliath. We would have been interested to see him stop at the brook and for a moment busy himself. And as he arose, we would have seen that in his right hand were five smooth stones. This was all that was in his hand, and he was walking toward a giant to do battle. But in his heart was faith in God. He knew the battle was the Lord's. The account indicates that Goliath disdained the youth and said, "Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." But young David, with complete faith in God, was unafraid. Note the courage in his words that came back to the approaching giant. "Thou comest to me with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled." So the boy with just some stones in his hand marched out as the opposing armies watched, and with his sling hurled the stone that slew mighty Goliath. This demonstration of faith in God has stirred many hearts for countless years. May we who are present servants of God keep it well in mind. As we engage in battle the hosts of evil, think not of their might, nor of our weakness. Instead, think as did David, whose final words to Goliath were, "All this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's." Yes, that which we have in our hand may be only a stick or a stone, but if the Lord indicates it is acceptable in service, it will be blessed abundantly. Just what do we have in our hand? In reverie, let us once more go back the many years unto the time of Jesus' earthly ministry. Imagine ourselves in a home in Bethany where are gathered to meet Jesus and his disciples. We behold this scene and note among those in fellowship Lazarus, who had been raised from the dead. And as we stand watching, we see a sister in the doorway manifesting much agitation of spirit as though uncertain about a decision. We reach her side and notice something in her hand, but before we can inquire concerning it, she moves quickly towards our Lord. When she reaches his location, we see that it is Mary, and she anoints him with the costly ointment from the alabaster box we had previously noted in her hand. Some of the disciples expressed indignation, saying, "To what purpose is this waste?" But Jesus defended her and said in that she had poured this ointment on him, she had done it for his burial. Of course, this was meaningless to them at this time. Nevertheless, The tone of his remarks were such that she felt commended and the disciples reproved. All she had in her hand was the precious ointment. Perhaps this was Mary of Bethany, so desirous of showing her love for the Lord because of awaking Lazarus from the dead. Did the Lord bless this simple act of devotion? Indeed he did. When the alabaster box was broken, the perfume quickly filled the room. Then all of Israel, and its fragrance is with us to this day, even where you are at this moment. This is true because Jesus said, as recorded in Matthew 26:13, "Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also be this, that this woman hath done, be told for a memorial of her." How beautifully this illustrates the Lord's approval of us serving one another. But one may say in doubt, "What can I do to be a blessing to my brethren?" To such we would reply, "What is that in thine hand?" If the Lord so appreciated an act of simple devotion that he decreed it should be told with the gospel, would not he be mindful of each thought of love one has toward another? And if we attempt to express it asking the Lord's blessing, it shall surely happen. How often a pen in the hand of a saint has been blessed by the Lord in bringing blessings to another. A saint who has recently been called home by our Lord was often the source of encouragement to her isolated brethren. It mattered not that her hands were gnarled with arthritis. With much time and great love in her heart, her aching fingers typed out for others a message of love and encouragement which the Lord blessed. It may be in our hand is just a stick, or a stone, perfume, or pen, but by the Lord's grace this can be used to bless others if our heart is willing. What is that in thine hand? Once again let our minds go back to the first period of the church's history. In Corinth we walk close by the water's edge, and there behold men at their several tasks. Fishermen are coming in from the night of toil. Laborers are bending back as they unload the ships from distant ports. And then we note two men in animated conversation, yet hard at work. To the older we inquire, "What is that in thine hand?" The hand held out for us to inspect has grasped between the thumb and forefinger a needle strung with thread. We ask of him, "What work do you do?" The answer, clear and forthright, comes back to us. "I serve God with this needle and thread." This imagined conversation could have happened if we'd ever talked to the Apostle Paul, because when he was called of God, in his hand was the needle and thread which he had learned to use as a sail and tent maker. It was all he possessed at the time, but he was willing to use it, and God wondrously blessed him in the service of the church. In Acts 18:1-3 we read, "Paul departed from Athens, and came to Corinth, and found a Jew named Aquila. And because he was of the same craft, he had bowed with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. Paul's time and talent was consecrated to God, and he considered himself merely the steward of these things which God could and did bless. His trade, which could be laborious, was a means of serving God." Note well Paul's love for and dedication to his brethren, as we read in 1 Thessalonians 2:7-9. "But we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because ye were dear unto us. For ye remember, brethren, our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God." What is in our hands? We may be salesmen, a mechanic, a gardener, or one of many other occupations, but do we consider it a means of serving God? Have we prayed that he open our eyes to our privileges, and seeing them, have we joyfully attempted to fulfill God's will? To a true child of God, only such a course can bring full joy and peace of heart. To Moses of old he blessed a stick in his hand. and with Gideon it was an earthen pitcher and lamp. Youthful David saw God bless his efforts with the pebble from the brook and Mary the perfume. Faithful Paul wrought night and day with his needle and thread. We must have something in our hand. We pray, dear Lord, to see and know that which we have, and humbly ask thy blessing on our efforts to serve thee, thy people, and thy truth.